CliffCentral.com.
Rabbi Yossi Goldman is probably most well known to all South Africans because he was one of the people on the religious broadcasting panel at the SABC. He's appeared many times on television and in radio. And he's a friend of mine, I think it's fair to say. I got to know him a couple of years ago. He invited me to come and address a dinner at his shul in Sydenham. And we struck up something of a friendship, and I consider him one of those wise people who I refer to in times where I'm not so sure what the hell's going on. And he is one of those people who also has a deep and abiding love for many, many things. No less his involvement in the Jewish community here in South Africa and in Johannesburg in particular. But a man who's been here now for 40 years, Rabbi, 40 years in South Africa.
As they say in Yiddish, oi. Wow.
Are you mad? I mean, are you sorry about any of that?
Thank God. We never looked back there, but I just can't believe it's 40 years. When I was a kid, people would say they remember things 40 years ago. I said, gee, they're so old.
Yeah, that's right. And it was 1976 when you came here. You're originally from Brooklyn in New York.
Brooklyn, New York. Studied in Montreal, Canada. Married my wife, Rochel, who hailed from Cleveland, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And I did postgraduate in New York for a couple of years. Had two kids there. And then got the call and the posting to Johannesburg. Had a lot of offers. I was a hot property, you know.
You still are.
I could have gone all over the world. And and I asked my saintly mentor and teacher, the late Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rabbi Schneerson of blessed memory, who was a visionary, a towering figure of our time. And he said Johannesburg. And so here I am 40 years later.
If you look back in 40 years, you must have seen a huge amount of change. I mean, you must have arrived at the time of those 1976 riots.
We landed the end of March 1976, so this March is 40 years. April, May, June, 3 months later, all hell broke loose. I remember my sister calling from New York, crying, "Come home!" New York Times headlines, "Riots hit Johannesburg, come home!" I said, "No, it's fine. I'm not going anywhere." And of course, when we came, the park across the street of where we lived in Berea at the time, the benches on the park said "whites only."
Huh.
You know, it was a culture shock for Americans coming here. And of course, we saw the upheavals and the ups and the downs, and the ultimate, miraculously peaceful democratic transition here in South Africa and Mandela. I mean, I remember many years ago the Star put out one of those fictitious scenario planning of 20 years hence, and the headline was "President Mandela says this, that, or the other," which at the time in the 70s was
unthinkable,
was science fiction, you know.
Sure.
I mean, it was absurd, and it came to pass. And no, thank God we've never looked back, and it's been very exciting. You know, this is an interesting place. The old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, but never a dull moment in South Africa. I don't know how people live in Australia. It's so boring.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think we're going through a very interesting... Look, all of my life in South Africa, I've found it fascinating and engaging in lots of ways. But I mean, it must be even more so for someone who can be objective, who comes from a place like New York, which is a fascinating place. I mean, I love New York to pieces. Do you feel more at home now? Do you still consider, is a part of you still in New York, or do you think you're a South African?
You know, we used to go home, in inverted commas, every year to visit the family. My parents were there, my siblings, my teacher, the Rebbe, and we would go at least once a year. And it took a few years, and once we came back with the kids, the family grew as we went along, and I remember, I don't know, maybe it was 5 years or so after coming, and we got back, and I said to my wife, you know, we've come home. And it sort of kicked in that, you know, this is now home. And that was a long time ago. That's maybe 35 years ago. So, no, there's no question this is home, and I'm much more comfortable here than anywhere else, including where I was brought up in New York. Of course, we go back to see the family and to see the people and the institutions, but New York per se, it is a great city. There's no question about it. But I'm very comfortable where we are.
You've got an incredible congregation. I met many of them when I came to one of the dinners that you organized there.
Well, you were our launch. You were.
Was I the first one?
You were the first one. We had we started a program of Friday night dinners for young adults to try and develop the next generation. And we sat down with a committee of young adults and said, okay, we'll have a dinner, but, you know, we need a guest speaker. Who would you like? And I was devastated. They didn't say me. They didn't even say any rabbi, actually. They said Gareth Cliff.
And you thought, oh, no.
Actually, I said, who's he? No, I'm teasing. No, you were already famous. And so I called you, and you were very gracious, and you accepted immediately, which I was very touched and very impressed with your accessibility and your humility, and you didn't stand on ceremony, and you very graciously came, and you were very well behaved too. I must tell you, I was on my best behavior. I got a lot of flack for taking this guy.
Did you?
You know, yeah, oh yeah. Some of the rabbis said I'm prostituting Judaism. You know,
oh really?
Yeah. But I stood my ground, and you vindicated me. You were great. And I loved watching the little kids come up to you during the service, you know. I think one kid even did something. He wanted you to sign his yarmie or something.
Yeah. I think I declined that. But Rabbi, we think that there is a lot to be spoken about in terms of change in this country. And I'm sure you've witnessed a lot of this, not only in your own congregation. The Jewish community in South Africa has shrunk a lot over the last 40 years.
We've lost about a third of our population.
Whew. That's never really.
It's a big chunk, and it has negative factors in our community, because every person who left, maybe there were five people working for him on average,
mm-hmm.
who are now unemployed.
Yeah.
So it was a big loss, and you know, people were worried. People were very insecure. What's going to be? Back in the 70s, when we came, people said, "Are you mad?
Yeah.
You left America to come here? We're sitting on a volcano.
Yeah,
it's going to erupt any minute. Look at the rest of Africa. Blood in the streets, violent revolutions."
It's this ongoing fearful tale that we get told by everybody, right?
You know, South Africans have been sitting on their suitcases for decades and decades. And and every now and then when there's a little hiccup, you know, and maybe the president and the finance minister aren't whatever, suddenly the suitcases come out again, you know.
And some leave, and the majority stay, and they sit on their suitcases a little longer.
Yeah. Look, I've preached for 40 years now. I've preached from the pulpit. I'm in the Sydenham congregation for nearly 30 years. I was running the Chabad house in Yeovil in the old days.
That must have been an exciting place to be.
From 76 to 86. Then that was the hub of where Jewish Central was. You know, it wasn't Cliff Central. It was Jewish Central. The Beth Din was in Yeovil. The kosher restaurants were in Yeovil. Synagogues galore and schools and so on. But, you know, what was. But I've preached for 40 years against emigration. In fact, when I was in Sydney a couple of years ago, I met with the rabbis there, and they thanked me for sending the South Africans, because they raised the bar of the Jewish community, of Jewish identity in Sydney, which was not so strong Jewishly. And the South Africans actually raised that bar, and they thanked me. I said, well, don't thank me. I told them not to go. But and it's fascinating. When I was in Australia, I mean, I think we were playing against them in cricket at the time. And I asked the South Africans I was bumping into, so who are you supporting? And they looked at me like I'm mad. What do you mean who we're supporting? Of course we're supporting South Africa. So you have all these schizophrenic South Africans living around the world, you know, missing their home and their culture and everything. And in the Jewish community, they, it's interesting how, whether it's Sydney or Melbourne or Boca Raton or Irvine, California, or Atlanta or Toronto, you know, where there's these enclaves of South Africans,
mm-hmm.
From a Jewish point of view, they've tried to replicate what they had here, and they've created their own South African-type synagogues, you know, with the choirs and the music and the kichel and herring that they're accustomed to, because basically they're homesick, you know. I mean, this is how they were brought up. And it's actually sad because it didn't have to be that way. I mean, now 40 years looking back, there was no violent revolution. It was, as I say, miraculously peaceful transition to democracy, which newspapers, you know, journalists don't usually talk about miracles. You know, that's reserved for synagogues and churches. And
they're usually negative and pessimistic about everything. But we did have a moment.
And the media had to acknowledge that this was a miraculously peaceful transition to democracy, which if people then in the 70s and 80s who were leaving knew how it would pan out, they would never have left. Yes, we got our problems.
What do you think of what's going on at the moment? You see all these young people on university campuses, and there's a lot of violence, and there's a lot of anger, and all of this stuff. What's your take on that?
My take is that it's being manipulated and engineered.
By politicians?
Politicians, or would-be politicians, or wannabe politicians. I mean, all of a sudden, what's going on all of a sudden? I mean, I think there's lots of opportunities. I'm sure there are things that still have to be corrected. I'm not suggesting for a moment that we've had the total transformation that people expect, but there also has to be a sense of a meritocracy, whether it's in government or it's in universities. I mean, you can't just award diplomas.
No, sure, you can't just give everybody the same thing.
So, what would our standards of education be, and what would, I mean, the... Do you want to go to surgery under the knife of a surgeon who got a
40%
sort of a diploma, who maybe was politically manipulated instead of on merit?
Oh, hell no. Do you want an airline pilot who isn't right 100% of the time?
Exactly, you know.
Rabbi, with the benefit of hindsight, though, and 40 years of experience in South Africa, there are all kinds of things that sometimes we don't see because we get wrapped up in the day-to-day news. And there's always a lot of bad news because that's what sells and that's what people like coughing to each other about, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
So do you see things that kind of make you feel that a lot of the time people need to just calm down, that there isn't enough of an appreciation for perspective?
100%. I've been saying that for a long time. You know, we've had quite a few very dramatic, scary moments over these 40 years. Steve Biko, Boy Patong, et cetera, et cetera. And where people think, okay, now it's happening, you know, now it's all going to fall apart. And I remind them the wise words of someone who was reputed to be the wisest of all men. His name was King Solomon. And apparently he had a ring with a slogan on it.
Yeah?
This too shall pass.
Is that what it said?
Mm.
You know how many times I've been in a situation and hoped that those words were the only words that mattered? Because, I had this situation in January, and you kind of hit a couple of lows, personally, and I'm sure everybody's gone through something like that. And it's good to hear things like that from people who, and this is where religion is helpful and useful.
If you believe in God, and it's not just that you believe that there's some kind of celestial being sitting on a cloud somewhere, but that he's actively engaged. My belief system is that God not only created the world, but he continues to be the MD of the world. He's not didn't create and then go on holiday. He's not in Mauritius, you know. He's actively engaged and guiding the world, and everything that happens is part of his vast eternal plan, to quote Fiddler on the Roof. And once you believe not only in God, but you believe that there is a vast eternal plan, that there is a a mission in life and a destiny that every human being has. Big or small, important or seemingly insignificant, every individual was created for a purpose. Birth means you matter, said my teacher. If you're alive, God wanted you here for a purpose. Don't feel a lack of self-esteem. Don't feel I'm useless, I'm meaningless, there's no purpose in my existence. What do you mean? God created you. Your parents couldn't do it themselves. You need that creative spark. You're here for a reason. If you're here for a reason, that gives you a great feeling that you count, that you matter, that you are important, even if you feel that you're insignificant in the big scheme of things. And if you believe that God is actually the engaged managing director of the world and everything that happens somehow is part of this big higher plan, then the lows in life can be seen as stepping stones to greater success. It's there for a purpose, yes. We go down. Sometimes you got to go down to go up. But it's part of the ongoing plan, which hopefully has a meaningful and productive and positive purpose to it.
I know you've probably been asked this so many times by your own members of the congregation. If it's true that God is this MD, how could he let things like the Holocaust happen? You know, I mean, that seems to me to be at very least careless, at very most malicious.
That's the million-dollar question, which has been asked in every single generation and on every single continent for millennia. And guess what? Even the original Jewish prophet, Moses himself, asked God that very question. Not about the Holocaust.
But the Egyptians at that stage.
Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do good things happen to bad people? Why, or in the ancient question, why do the wicked prosper? Why do the righteous suffer? Which is the same as why do bad things happen to good people and the converse of that. So there are classical philosophical discussions. There are books. There are libraries, not books. There are libraries written on this question. You know, it's easy to ask a philosophical question. It's not so easy to answer it. How many hours have you got?
I'm keen to listen. You see, this is what I also love about the Jewish religion, and the way Judaism is taught is that you encourage questions, and you encourage curious minds, and sometimes, if you don't know the answer, everybody pores over it for a long time. It's this idea that there's the Torah, and you can learn from that. But there's also this Talmudic study that happens.
Which is part of Torah.
Right. And you take bits and you extrapolate upon them, and you philosophize around them, and you find the wisest possible position on certain things.
Have you ever heard the term Stumpowder?
Must have. Something to do with shutting up.
Exactly. So in the Jewish community, it's like a colloquialism, take a Stumpowder, which is a nice way of saying shut up, you know? and we don't believe that.
Yeah.
The Talmud is replete with questions, with arguments, with challenges, with rebuttals, with counter-rebuttals. Until we finally...
5,000 years of it.
Not quite, but, you know, a long time. Until we finally get to the bottom line and what is the law. And it's debated. And it's debated. And there's open, genuine, intellectual honesty and strident, vibrant, vigorous intellectual debate by the greatest sages. So we encourage debate. We don't encourage Stumpowders, and we don't tell anybody, shh, don't, no, you mustn't ask that question. That's disrespectful. That's unfaithful. No, that's not our attitude. You're allowed to ask why. I can't promise that I'm going to have an answer to every question, but let's find that together. You know, if the rabbi doesn't know, we'll ask Rabbi Google or something. We'll find an answer, you know.
By Google.
But I'm doing a course now, an adult education course called Judaism Decoded. And the subtitle is Prepare to Question the Unquestionable. we actually encourage people to question that which is seemingly off limits and unquestionable.
But what
how do I know God? How do I know Torah? How do I know it's true? How do I know Moses existed? How do I know that this Jewish tradition that's been handed down thousands of years is actually authentic and not a broken telephone? So we're going through that, and we're doing a 6-week course on that, you know, showing it. So we don't shy away from questions, and in terms of bad things happening to people, whether it's the Holocaust, which is the biggest tragedy to occur to the Jewish nation in all its history, is to lose 6 million people, a third of our people wiped out, including my own paternal grandparents. My father's the only survivor of his whole family from Poland. Today, thank God, that sole survivor has over 80 great-grandchildren.
Wow.
So I say he won, not Hitler.
Yeah, good. That's one way to look at it.
Yeah.
It is sad that there were so many people who don't have that happy ending. And I think more than sad, for a lot of people, there was an interesting article I read the other day that the descendants of Holocaust survivors carry a lot of that pain, not only spiritually and emotionally, but even in their genes.
There have been books and treatises and essays and doctorates written on the mindset of not only survivors who have some guilt.
There's guilt.
Why did I survive? Yeah, right. You know, but the children of survivors, because their parents didn't talk about it.
Mm.
They couldn't talk about it. It was too painful. They suppressed it. I didn't find out my father's story until I was an adult.
Hmm. And did he tell you or someone else tell you?
Eventually he told me. All the years we just had the basic, you know, three-line story. Details, only in the 90s did he finally really open up. And it was actually on a radio program because, as you know, I ran the Jewish Sound radio show for 24 years. And he was here visiting for one of my son's bar mitzvah. I think it was 91. And I said, you know, how about I'd love to have a conversation with a survivor on the radio. And to my shock, he agreed. And there I am recording him. It was pre-recorded in the studio, Atkinson House in Joburg, old Swazi radio, where one of your competitors were born. And he opened up. It was fascinating. I got two old cassette recordings of my father. And eventually he wrote a book, which I helped him edit and publish.
But hearing it for the first time, you must have been very emotional.
It was very difficult to be a dispassionate interviewer and a son simultaneously, but somehow we managed. It was pre-recorded, so we could close the tape and start again. But getting back to the big question, whether it's 6 million or it's one child, qualitatively is the very same question. God forbid a family loses a child. God forbid a terror attack. For that family, it's a Holocaust.
Hmm.
So the question is the same, you know, whether it's suffering. Okay, you know, we shouldn't get too philosophical if we stub our toes. But, you know, whether it's one or it's 6 million, essentially the question is the same.
And as you said, your teacher told you, if you're born, you matter.
So ultimately...
So life is sacred.
Ultimately, we believe that there's not only life as we see it, but there's also a world to come. And once you believe in a world to come, where everything will be balanced, rebalanced, all injustices will be redressed, then it makes it a little bit more tolerable.
It just makes the living... Do you want some water? Can we get some water quickly, Flax? Sorry. There's some in our fridge.
Sorry.
In the office. No, not a problem.
Been coughing today.
No, not a problem. Let me get you some water. I'm sorry we didn't bring some in the first place.
I mean, that's the age-old classical explanation, you know, that it's only a half-baked article. Don't jump to conclusions, you know. The world to come, then.
We haven't finished the story.
See, yeah. It's only one side of the coin. You know? There.
But it doesn't make living on Earth any easier for the people who are going through that.
No. But what's easier is that if you know that there's a purpose to it, if you know that there's a plan, a higher plan,
uh-huh.
Thank you, a knowledgeable plan, a plan of with content, not just, then it's easier to accept. But if it was random, if it's the throw of the dice, if it's the luck of the draw, random selection, I could not handle it. Then, indeed, why me?
Yeah.
But if you believe that there's a big plan, and somehow one day, whether it's in this world or the next world, but one day I'll see the purpose of it all, and a positive purpose in this somehow will be revealed. The great mysteries of the universe, the cosmic mysteries will be revealed one day, and we'll see that it was not only a purpose, but a positive purpose. Then I can live with faith. I always say, I tell my people, listen, guys, you need not only faith, you need patience. You're not going to get the answers tomorrow necessarily.
But Rabbi, again, 5,000 years. How much patience do we need?
Okay, we need to have limitless patience.
I'm interested you've spoken quite a lot, and you gave a very important address in 2005 on the 60th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And I only bring this up, and I really didn't bring you here to have a whole discussion about the Holocaust. There's lots of much, much happier stuff we can get into. But this is important to me. I think it's an important thing for humanity. And it gives us, again, that perspective on how lucky we are to be alive now and how fortunate we are to have got through that period of human history where so much went so wrong and could have gone even more wrong. And you've spoken, I'm sure, at length about this, but anti-Semitism is something that I think we need to address. We need to talk about. And I think it's something that very few people understand. They kind of think it's just this idea that there's discrimination and prejudice against Jews. And it's a lot more than that.
It's been called the world's longest hatred. I actually give a talk about it. In fact, I'm going to Europe next month on a lecture tour. I'm actually quite touched. I was invited by the Catholic University in Rome to give a lecture there in April, and so I'm going to do a few lectures in the Jewish community in Zurich and London and possibly one or two other places. And one of my hot topics is why the Jews? Is there a reason for anti-Semitism? And many reasons have been postulated over the years, but my bottom line conclusion is that none of them wash, none of them are a justifiable reason, and none of them are logical. In fact, one of the things I quote a rabbi from Warsaw, Poland, who died in the Warsaw Ghetto during the Holocaust, who was a great scholar, and many of his writings, not all tragically, but many of his writings did survive. His name was Rabbi Menachem Zemba, and he, to make a long story short, he just proves very simply, but very powerfully, how illogical anti-Semitism is. And he says, look, in Germany, they didn't like the Jews because the Jews were successful. And he said, well, they're taking our money away.
Hmm.
In Poland, they didn't like the Jews. The Jews were poor. Polish Jews were not very successful.
So we put them in ghettos and, forget about them.
So they're scum of the earth, they're dirty, they're whatever. In Russia, they didn't like the Jews because they were bourgeoisie capitalists. In America, they went on witch hunts that the Jews are communists. So he says, you can't win. If we're successful, it's no good. If we're unsuccessful, it's no good. If we're communists, it's no good. If we're capitalists, it's no good. You can't win. In other words, there is no rationale. There is no logic. And it's something which is there, and people find the hooks to hang it on, whatever. Jews are pushy. Jews are this. The Pope has thankfully exonerated the Jews from what the generations of Christians thought we did, which we never did. And that's part of why I'm being invited to Rome, because it's the 50th anniversary of Nostra Aetate, and the relations between Jews and Catholics are much rosier now than they were.
Rosier, but you can't forgive the kinds of things that were perpetrated under the Catholic Church for thousands of years because of pogroms and this insane belief that the Jews were the ones who murdered Jesus, and that as a result, I mean, Jesus was a Jew. And that there seems to be this idea now that, oh, all is forgiven. But many thousands, if not millions of people didn't make it because of these insane ideas.
Yeah. I'm not the first rabbi to have been asked that point. I recall one of the former chief rabbis of Israel, Rabbi Lau, a dear friend of mine who's today the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He went back to his old position after being chief rabbi of Israel. And a very powerful person whose autobiography and memoir called Out of the Depths is required reading by everybody, Jew and non-Jew, in my opinion. He was a child survivor of Treblinka, one of the concentration camps, one of the death camps. Imagine a child of Treblinka who rises to become the chief rabbi of Israel. What a story.
Mm.
And that story, I once spoke, I was together with him at a European Jewish retreat in Italy, and I had to introduce him, and I said, that story of this Rabbi Lau is the story of the Jewish people. Because look where we were 70 years ago, and look where we are today. Okay, anti-Semitism hasn't gone away. Now it's called anti-Zionism, so there's a new label and a new hook to hang it on. But it's the same old thing. And but we thank God, we have a state of Israel. We have we can defend ourselves. We are giving the world not only Jaffa oranges, but a hell of a lot of technology and medical breakthroughs.
There's more innovation happening in that little strip of land than almost anywhere in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, we're very proud of it.
And that is an incredible thing. I mean, Israel is an important part of the whole picture, of the whole story. And for the first time in thousands of years, there is now a home for Jewish people.
So many Jews look at Israel as a last resort escape clause. God forbid things go wrong, you can always go to Israel, you know, and thank God for that.
But there's this little place, it had to really struggle for survival in its first couple of weeks of existence. It wasn't an easy start.
It wasn't an easy start, and it's still not easy. But I find it quite incredible that only the other month they have these annual happiness surveys around the world, you know, which country, which citizens of which country are the happiest. And they have a whole set of scientifically worked out questions to the... And Israel, I think, was 15th or 16th or something on the list of the happiest. I find it phenomenal. And here, people living with an existential threat. Any second, someone's going to bomb you, stab you, car ram you, or come out with a terror tunnel under your feet, God forbid. And people threatening to drive you into the sea for the last 60 years. And
yet
these
happy.
Are the happiest people. It's unbelievable. It's inspiring.
There's something, though, to be said for the Jewish sense of humor. If there ever is a kind of cultural stereotype you're allowed to attribute, it seems that Jewish people have always been able to laugh at themselves. And it seems that Jewish people have always been able to tell really funny stories.
I have a talk called The Smile Behind the Tear.
Oh, yeah?
And it's how humor sustained us through all the difficulties of Jewish history. We could laugh at ourselves, you know, like the two Jews who were facing the firing squad. And they're already starting the countdown, you know, and the one guy starts swearing at his captors, and the other guy says, shh, you'll get us in trouble.
You see, that's exactly the thing I'm talking about. You obviously have been to Israel many times. Tell me about Jerusalem. I would love to go. I still have to go. You invited me, actually. And I've got to make good on that promise. It's a place that I think would be fascinating to me just as a student of history. But what is Jerusalem to you, and what is it like there, and what do you wish for that place?
For me to go to Israel and not to be based in Jerusalem is unthinkable. I took a synagogue tour a couple of years ago, and we did virtually the entire country in a week. It was quite amazing. It was nonstop day and night. We were exhausted. We came back from this week of holiday and we needed a holiday. But
there's a lot to see.
But we insisted to be based in Jerusalem, and especially over the Sabbath, Shabbat in Jerusalem. I mean, we went to the Western Wall on Friday night, and there were just hundreds and hundreds of young people singing and dancing, and different little congregations springing up all over. In fact, the one group next to us was praying so loudly according to their particular Ukrainian tradition.
Yeah.
We couldn't hear a word we were saying. So we said, guys, you can't fight it, so let's just let them finish and then we'll start our little service, you know, and so we did. And then I was inspired, so I started dancing, you know. We don't usually dance in the synagogue. It's a big place, you know. But this was a special occasion, and we started singing and dancing, and then suddenly the whole Western Wall Plaza joined the Sidnam Jewel dance. It was unbelievable how this little group from Johannesburg suddenly became the center of attention. So Jerusalem is the ancient city. It's the holy city. It's mentioned hundreds and hundreds of times in the Bible, in Jewish scripture, and the prophets. King David established it over 3,000 years ago. King Solomon built the first temple there. And the Western Wall is on one hand, a glorious shrine. On the other hand, a sad remnant of a great house that once stood.
It's all that's left of that temple, right?
Yeah. There was great and glorious activity on the other side of those walls. And today we have absurd pronouncements by our detractors claiming there never was a temple. It's a mythology. I mean, any archaeologist will show you scientific proof. But we have our history, and we know exactly what went on. And it's a very special thing to be able to say a prayer at the wall and put a little note in one of the cracks in the wall and sort of a direct message to God above. It's a special delivery. You know, they say from Jerusalem, heaven is a local phone call, you know. It's not long distance. So and I'm very proud to say that Israel has shown tremendous respect and goodwill to all faiths, protecting all houses of worship of all faiths, which was not the case before 1948. Every synagogue virtually was destroyed and desecrated by the Jordanians at the time. I think there was one that was left intact. Everything else had to be rebuilt. They took stones of synagogues and made latrines out of them. It was tombstones, Jewish tombstones used for latrines, total desecration. And we are showing the utmost respect for every faith. All the Christian and Muslim houses of worship are respected and well maintained, and anybody can go. And then whenever I go to Israel, there's always a group of Christian pilgrims from somewhere in the world who are going, and they have the most wonderful time. I remember a Friday night in a Jerusalem hotel, and there was one group of Christians from Texas, actually. And the Jewish groups were singing the traditional Sabbath melodies, and they were just looking and watching. They were wide-eyed. They'd never seen this before. And people dressed in their Sabbath regalia. And I could see that they were lost and curious. And they didn't seem to have a tour guide who was explaining to them what's going on. So I took it upon myself, my wife and I, we went over there. And they were so grateful. They were full of questions. You know, what's this? What's that? What are you doing? And I answered all their questions, and they couldn't stop thanking me. And we became good friends from then, because we kept bumping into each other in the hotel. And so it's a holy city, and there's no reason why it can't be a peaceful city, as far as we are concerned.
Why is it that so many Jews want to be buried on that Western slope, the eastern or the western side?
I have a late uncle who lived in New York, and he was buried in Israel.
Yeah.
He left it in his will, and he'd made arrangements. He'd purchased the plot while he was alive, and he told his family, that's That's where, when it happens, that's where you must send me. And I visited him once there. And it's an old tradition to be buried in the Holy Land. Again, it's a local phone call. It's a local trip.
Yeah.
We believe that in the end of days, in the Messianic times, which hopefully are not far away, hopefully it's imminent, that we'll have that great day of peace once and for all. Finally, the Messianic age will be upon us. And one of the principles of Jewish theology is that the dead will be revived again, as absurdly Hitchcockian as that may sound. It's one of our core beliefs. You know, if God could create us from scratch, why can't he recreate us? It's not mm-hmm. such a big deal. Therefore, instead of rolling all the way to the Holy Land from West Park Cemetery, Johannesburg, it's much easier to be on the spot, you know?
Where it's all happening, in the middle of the action.
Yeah.
What's your hope, though, for Jerusalem?
There's hope and there's realism. Unfortunately, the two don't always match. I hope. I always hope and pray. It should be what it is meant to be, a city of peace, a city of brotherly love. As far as the Israeli authorities are concerned, they pledge to give everybody their place in the sun and to protect everybody's rights and to make sure. I mean, the Six-Day War, Israel lost a hell of a lot of young men who were in house-to-house, alley-by-alley combat. They could have sent a few bombs and spared all those young lives. They didn't do it out of respect. They didn't want to damage houses of worship of other faiths. Tell me another people in times of war who have that sensitivity. So from our point of view, we are happy to see it as a city of peace, of brotherly love. We're happy for all faiths to come and worship in their houses of worship. We will protect that right and safeguard their ability. But it is the eternal capital of the Jewish people. Always was and always will be. Other people have other capitals. This is not the number one place in Islam. I mean, there's other more important places.
Mecca and Medina,
exactly,
for starters,
right.
And then maybe Jerusalem.
Yeah,
but it's also interesting that, you know, there seems to be this idea that different rules must apply to Israel than to everyone else.
It's called a double standard.
Yeah,
it's also called hypocrisy, and it's also called anti-Semitism.
There we go. Now, Rabbi, on to slightly more pleasant things. I'm sure you have hopes for South Africa, too. And I mean, looking around now, there are things that obviously concern us politically. There are things that concern us about society. There are things about the economy that worry all of us. But what do you think? What do you think the future of this country is?
I've always been positive. My saintly teacher, Lubavitcher Rebbe, was always positive. He said South Africa will be good for all time and that people should not panic and people should not run away. And I stand by that. And if you are able to take a step back and be a little bit more objective and get a little bit more perspective, you could actually, I mean, you have to be a prophet to see that these developments are actually positive. Because it's becoming very clear to people what's going on. Whether it's developments with Nkandla, or whether it's parliament, or whether it's finance and government and business starting to talk to each other for the first time in ages, and now we hear, God forbid, the many thousands of jobs possibly, God forbid, being lost in the mining sector, and maybe people realizing that we have to really talk to each other and find a better way of doing things instead of being at each other's throats and confrontational, and it's got us nowhere. In fact, we're going backwards, and God forbid we get junk status. I mean, I got kids to support overseas. I have children around the world, and each in their missions. Not that they left South Africa, but they each have a mission. They're all doing good work. I've got 4 children in Cape Town doing good work, in Johannesburg, but also I have others around the world, and try supporting kids overseas at 16 rand to the dollar.
Not easy.
So a little bit we have ourselves to blame for this. And it seems that people are finally starting to get it. And I think if we get it and we do work together, whether it's government and business or the private sector, public sector, people of different races and genders and faiths, there's no reason why we can't all work together for a common cause and have a better, peaceful and prosperous country, please God.
Well, Rabbi, I mean, you've said it all. I think that you live this incredible life and you live the words that you say. You're one of those people who, you know, your actions speak louder than your words, and you continue to do good work here in South Africa. And I know that your congregation love you deeply. Is there such a thing as retirement for a rabbi?
Did you have to ring that up?
I don't know. I mean, it's something you might want
to.
I can't afford
to retire.
You might get tired, though.
Well, I'm still reinventing myself.
All the best with this trip that you've got planned for Europe.
Thank you.
And please carry on the good work. Thank
and you,
Rabbi.
Too, Gareth. God bless you. And please, God, we should continue to hear good news from you, and your future career should develop. And we're not allowed to worship idols, but I wish you well.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi. CliffCentral.com.